your bright reel too. I suppose this feeling that the quality of the senior officers was less good than the quality of the new recruits could have been rather embarrassing for you outside of the Corps itself, within the wider environs of the Army, because one's senior officers are the people who make the impression of the Corps as a whole.
I think that is so. In fact, there were times, I know, when we discussed it amongst ourselves, and we were a bit concerned with the general image of the Corps outside. But I think we were sufficiently long-sighted to realize that this would right itself in time, because we knew that the first direct entry into the Royal Tank Corps had come from, in 1925, from the Royal Military Academy, from the Royal Military College, I beg your pardon, with a few from the Royal Military Academy, very few. And we knew them intimately, being friends of ours, and we had no doubts that when the direct entry came into the senior positions of the Royal Tank Corps, it would be just as good, if not better, than any other corps in the Army. And therefore, we all realized it was an interim period. And I don't think, as far as I can remember, that any of the transfer officers lasted more than the first few months of the last war. They were all replaced.
What were the general attitudes and sort of style of the young recruits to the RTC? I mean, did you feel a little diffident by the fact that you were a new arm and had a sort of, not a doubtful future, but a rather unknown one?
I don't think so, because we had a very high esprit de corps. We had, of course, an extremely fine leader and example in General Hubbard, who was a very difficult man, but he was completely dedicated, and he hadn't the slightest doubt about the future of the Royal Tank Corps and of armoured warfare in general. He also attracted Little Hart, who we saw and read his articles and so on when we got on to our training after we joined our battalions. And I think, in general, the esprit de corps of the Royal Tank Corps was very high. We realised that we had some limitations in regards, perhaps we thought that some of our senior officers weren't all they should have been, but nevertheless, we thought we were on the up and up, and we had an extremely fine, if somewhat difficult, leader in General Hubbard, who was certainly going to see that we got somewhere and that we got our fair share of such advantages there might be financially and in recognition and so on within the Army.
Can you remember during these early years any specific occasions when General Hubbard may have perhaps been doing a little propagandizing amongst you young recruits to try and...
Oh, yes, indeed. He used to talk to us when we used to concentrate as a brigade, and the only tank brigade there was, on Salisbury Plain at Till's Head every year. General Hubbard used to make a point of talking to all of us, not only the officers, but the other ranks as well, and telling us what the training was for, what we were going to do, and why we were going to do it. And also, he used to give us quite often the sort of background of thinking. For example, he told us that we were liable to be tackled by various visiting staff officers from the War Office, who might well say to us that wouldn't it be better to concentrate on light tanks instead of medium tanks, because light tanks were so much cheaper and we'd have so many more of them. And General Hubbard spelt out to us the reasons as to why we should withstand this argument and say that as far as we were concerned, as a corps, we were 100% behind the idea that we must have medium or heavy tanks, whether we had light tanks or not.
Now, this course at Bovington, what was its purpose?
Its purpose was to turn us into Royal Tank Corps officers. That is to say, we learnt as much drill, which was peculiar to the Royal Tank Corps, in that we were armed when mounted with pistols and not with rifles or swords or anything else. We did the ordinary sort of young officers training for ceremonial purposes, which we did have to do sword drills and things like that. But in general, it was to turn us into Royal Tank Corps officers after the general training, general army training, which we had received as cadets, mostly at Sandhurst.
And this training, was it a formal, structured training?
Yes, I would say it was well thought out, and a lot of the time was spent at the driving maintenance school doing the mechanical side of business, but also enough time, I think, was spent on drill, which was peculiar to the Royal Tank Corps in these days, and also to our own tactics. Our tactics were fairly elementary in those days. Mm. They hadn't been very highly developed. A lot of them were, in fact, somewhat based, when it came to actual tank battles, on naval battles, because in those days there was still an idea, really basically, that a tank was perhaps a little like a ship on land.
The tactical part of the training, was it theoretical or practical as well?
A bit of both. We did schemes, what we called TUPEs, that's tactical exercises without troops. We did schemes, and also we did a certain amount of stuff on sand tables and theoretical tactics and training as well.
Mm-hmm. So you were being instructed in what it was felt by the Corps to be the role of the tank.
That's it. Yes. And what would be expected of an officer in the Royal Tank Corps as regard to specialist knowledge as opposed to an officer in one of the other arms. Mm.
Well, within this tactical part of the course, what roles did you discover that were you instructed the tank existed to carry out?
Well, very largely, even in those days, we were beginning to realise that the tank was essentially a weapon of mobile warfare, that it had mobility which no other arm had. And I think perhaps we were a little slow in those days to realise that we required to be supported by other arms. There was a slight tendency when I first joined, I think, to feel that the tank brigade could take off on its own. It was later realised this was not so, and that it was an integral part of the all-arms battle. I think possibly in my young days, a little extra stress, and maybe there was no harm in this, in that if you want to get anything off the ground, you've got to have enthusiasts. And I think the people who used to teach us tactics in those days were enthusiasts.
Hmm. Well, can I try and pin you down a bit more about what they actually taught you and how far the practical exercises supported the theoretical training? I mean, what I don't understand is what they were saying in this six-month induction course that you had, and then what you were doing as a on the practical side to put these theories into operation.
Well, of course, at the Tank Corps Centre in those days, there were only vehicles for technical training, really, to learn to drive and maintain and so on, so that any tactical exercises had to be done without troops. That is to say, you couldn't actually have a tank battalion and manoeuvre it because we hadn't got one. You had to wait until you got out to your battalion after that to actually see the things on the ground. Mm. You could only really be told the sort of things that might happen. The actual real tactical training, I would say, took place as a young officer after you joined your battalion.
Let's try and break this training course down a bit more into its component parts. You've already mentioned that there were special tank corps drills.
Yes.
Tell me about those drills.
Well, they were drills as regards mounting your tanks, falling in front of the tanks, and the sort of weapon drill one used to do with the rifle, but we had to do with the pistols, presented to be inspected and that sort of thing.
Well, what was
pretty elementary.
What was the drill? Mounting your tanks, getting in front of your tanks?
Yes, you used to fall in front of the tanks. We used to have the order was cruise front, and you fell in front of your tank, and then you were ordered to mount, and you all had to mount and take up your respective positions in the tanks, ready to move off, and then after that you were mounted, you were given your order over the either over the wireless or by flags, because wireless was in a fairly young time of development as regards being put into vehicles. We had wireless of a sort in our tanks when I first joined, but it was very unreliable, and a lot of the commands were given by flags.
How did they do that?
Well, you've hoisted a flag out of the top of your turret. The company commander hoisted flags out of the top of his turret, which told you what you've got to do. And again, this is very like a naval drill, if you like. We were told to either go in line ahead, which I think ships do exactly the same, or we were told to various orders for arrowhead formations and for spreading out and so on. That was done by flags.
Can you remember what flag signals represented what particular drills?
Not now, no.
Okay,
no.
Fine.
There will be records of it. I mean, there must have been a training manual of those days, which I've no doubt get access to.
You had a course at the driving and maintenance school you mentioned. How thorough grounding did that give you in the mechanics of your duties?
Oh, very good indeed. As I tell you, it's excellent. I know of no course that I've ever been on or heard of that was any better. Mm. They literally did teach you to take your tank pieces and put it together again. It was very good indeed.
Do you want to describe it?
Well, it was the sort of course that you would expect. That is to say, we had very experienced instructors. We used to have to dismantle all parts of the vehicle and put them together again. We had to know what their function was and what likely repairs were and how we repaired them. And we had to be able to do that with our own hands.
Mm-hmm. The driving school, there you were being plunked in a tank for the first time to be taught how to drive it. Tell me about that first experience, what it was like.
Well, a tank is fairly easy to drive if you can drive an ordinary vehicle. And we were taught on lorries and armoured cars before we were put in tanks. And as most of us in those days could drive cars anyway, this was a step from driving your own private car to driving a heavy vehicle, driving a lorry or driving an armoured car, as the case might be, and from then going on to driving a tank. And in fact, to drive a tank is not very difficult. The difficulty about driving a tank really is the finer points of it, when you go over an obstacle, to know when to take your foot off the accelerator so it doesn't bump over the top, it rocks over. But you can learn that very quickly if you've got any mechanical sense at all. If you can drive a motor car well, you can very soon learn to drive a tank well. If you can't drive a motor car well, and some people can't, you would never drive a tank well.
Did you react with any feelings of either personal discomfort or claustrophobia or anything else during those first few occasions when you had to operate within the tank?
Oh, no. No, I would say not. In those days, of course, you had your head out while you were driving. When you were learning to drive, you weren't closed down. You had your head out. No, I would say one enjoyed it rather as an adventure. It was a strange machine that you were driving, and it was rather fun to learn to drive.
What sort of tanks were you training on?
Vickers mediums, Vickers medium Mark I and Vickers medium Mark II.
What did you think of them?
We thought they were good by standards of those years. They were probably as good as any other tanks in the world at those days. I think probably we were all a little doubtful as to how they would perform in actual war, but
Why were you doubtful?
Well, because they had very thin armour. They wouldn't keep much out. They had very thin armour, and mechanically they weren't all that reliable. Well, you see, they were designed in the early 20s, so they were about 10 years old at the time I'm talking about, as regards design-wise. I don't mean to say some of the vehicles weren't fairly recent manufacture, but the design was fairly old. And if you compare it with the motor car of the 20s, that wasn't all that reliable either. You see, mechanical things in those days weren't reliable in the sense they are now. Motor cars weren't.
Mm. From the point of view of being a crew member, were there any particular defects in either of these machines which struck you?
I don't think so. I think we thought they were as good as could be under the limitations of design in those days. And also, we also realised the limitations of money. That is to say that if there was a great technological improvement suddenly, we couldn't expect all our tanks to be scrapped and get new ones, because we knew we jolly well wouldn't. We knew we were going to go on training with these comparatively old machines.
Did you have any views as to the comparative merits of the Mark I and Mark II?
Well, the Mark II was a straight development from the Mark I. That was all. The Mark II was mechanically a bit better than the Mark I. There wasn't all that difference between them, really.
Did you think these machines were capable of doing the kinds of things you were trained to believe that was the role of the tanks?
Probably in the 30s, yes, but I would say that as years went on, we realised that if there was going to be a war, we'd better get some new vehicles.
So at the time we're talking about, you thought, right, these machines are fine, very forefront of tank technology.
That's all we've got. This was very much, I would say, a background. We did say we were pretty materialistic in those days because, you see, we didn't think then that there were unlimited coffers of money which could give us new vehicles and so on. We reckoned we were stuck with what we'd got, and we'd got to make the best of them.
Was there then a lot of make-do and mending going on within the tank corps?
Tremendous amount.
What sort of forms did it take?
Well, for instance, one training season when our Carden Lloyds had either given out or been handed over to the cavalry, who were using them as training to get mechanised, we had two-wheel drive trucks with flags on, which we used to say were like tanks for all our manoeuvres. One brigade manoeuvres on Salisbury Plain one summer, we had nothing but two small two-wheel trucks, thing that you call a pickup now, I suppose, with flags on to simulate like tanks. It was very much a make-do and mend. Mm.
Did you continue to be associated with the Vickers Medium after this initial period?
Well, right up till the time I went to the Military College of Science in the autumn of 1937, that was our main armament. And in fact, not only the battalions at home, but the 6th Battalion, who I was serving with when I came home to go to the Military College of Science, were equipped with Vickers Mark II medium tanks.
As a crew member, was there any feeling that although you were using the same basic machine, it was noticeably improving with various modifications and things?
Not really. It was improved in detail. For example, it was modified to take a modern wireless set so that we could do away with flags and we communicated entirely over the wireless. That was one great improvement, of course. It was made slightly mechanically more reliable, various modifications were carried out. It was made perhaps slightly more comfortable for the crew. But it was only in detail. Basically, it remained the same vehicle.
At the end of this six-month period, were you able to judge whether the Corps had any particular style? I mean, it was a young Corps, you said, but had it developed any traditions or any particular ethos which by that time you had sort of inculcated?
Yes, I think to some extent it had, because we were all, in any lectures we might have had on regimental history, always went back to Cambrai, which was the time the tanks broke through in the 1418 war. And you see, this was really a revolution in the 1418 war, in that until the appearance of the tank, the machine gun and the barbed wire had complete dominance of the battlefield. Mm. And I think it was stressed to us, and I think we understood quite readily that the appearance of the tank was a revolution in warfare as understood during the 1418 war, and that we realised, and we considered that we were the protagonists, if you like, of the new art.
Now, after the period of Bovington, you went on to the College of Science, Military College of Science at Woolwich. Was this a standard part of the training for RTC officers?
Yes, it was at that time. It was subsequently modified. I think only the next entry after ours did it in this order, because it was then felt that if you did 18 months of solid courses when you joined the Royal Tank Corps without going to a battalion, you would begin to wonder what being in the Royal Tank Corps was all about, and feel that you weren't becoming an officer, which after all was what you joined the army to become. So that I think the next entry after us did the same as we did, but thereafter they used to do their courses at the Royal Tank Corps Centre in drill and driving and maintenance, and also at the gunnery school at Lulworth. And then they used to go and join their battalions for either a year or longer, and then go back and do their theoretical training at the Military College of Science at Woolwich. Mm-hmm. Because the 6 months course at the Military College of Science at Woolwich was entirely theoretical.
What in outline did the course at Woolwich consist of?
Elementary engineering, mathematics, physics. In fact, really, it was an extension of the normal education you might get in basic subjects at school. Hydrostatics. We did a bit of metallurgy. We did a certain amount of chemistry as regards fuel and lubricants and things like that. But although you could say that fuels and lubricants were perhaps particularly applicable to a corps which drove vehicles, much of the other was really general education.
Hmm. Well, that leads me on to the next question. I was going to ask you, was much or any of the course specifically directed at tanks?
Very little. Very little. It was really almost entirely theoretical.
Despite the fact that as a class you were all tank corps officers?
Yes. But you see, it was considered that we ought to know a bit about chemistry as regards, say, the composition of armour. We ought to know a little about chemistry as regards fuels and lubricants. But also, we ought to have a general knowledge of physics and chemistry, because I suppose it was thought in those days that a tank officer ought to be perhaps rather better educated in as regards a technical background than we would be required of officers in the infantry. But on the other hand, it was a general technical education. I wouldn't say it was particularly slanted towards going to the tank corps.
What was the attitude of the RT officers in your class to this training course?
In general, they were rather bored with it. Because, again, they felt that they wished to get on with the business of being an army officer. And there was, I think, a general feeling that they didn't see why this general education, which I've stressed is what it was, a sort of general education and physical scientific, if you like, they didn't really see that this was particularly relevant to being a tank corps officer.
I see.
And this is one of the reasons why it was subsequently decided that they wouldn't do this course. Initially, they would go to their battalions first and then come back and do it.
Fine. Now, the next phase of your training was at the RTC Gunnery School at Lulworth. What was the gunnery school like when you went there? Could you sort of describe it physically for me?
Yes, it was a hutted camp. It was, again, to some extent, make do and mend, in that the accommodation was a bit primitive. The mess was hutted. The ranges were limited in their facilities. We had good facilities for machine gun practice and so on. The amount of gunnery you did with the main armour of the tank was probably limited by the cost of expenditure of rounds. You see, even in those days, a a shell fired out of your two-pounder gun was very expensive compared to, say, 1,000 rounds of ammunition fired out of a machine gun. So that the amount of actual gunnery you could do on the ranges was limited. But this was made up to a very large extent by the fact that there were good facilities on miniature ranges. We had miniature ranges which had simulated tank battles on them, that you fired an air rifle and at a panorama which was three-dimensional, and I would say the simulation was very good. And in fact, the degree of training you would get on these simulated ranges was so good that when you got out on the open range, you didn't have much difficulty in engaging and hitting your target fairly quickly. So that I would say they did a very good job in making sure that the very limited amount of live ammunition that we were able to fire out of the main tank armament was used to good effect. I would say the training there was very good.
I must say, on the face of it, to a complete layman like myself, it doesn't sound to me as if firing an air gun at silhouettes has much to do with firing a two-pounder gun from a moving tank.
Well, it does, because you've got to pick up your target. That's the first thing you've got to do. You've got to pick it up in your telescope, which is, requires a certain amount of practice. You've got to pick it up. You've got to aim off for, or you had to in those days. Now this is done in your sight. But in those days, you had to aim off for the speed of the thing. And the simulation was very good. In fact, if you could hit the a target on a miniature range with your air gun, you wouldn't be far off, probably, with the first time you fired your... because you would go through the same drill. You would pick up your target, you would lay off correctly for the estimated speed of the target and so on. And by carrying out this drill, mind you, firing was much easier in those days, speeds were much slower and so on. On the other hand, as against that, you hadn't got any stabilisation. Your tank was rocking about all the time and you had to choose a moment when your gun was stationary in order to pull the trigger. So, well, we, again, as I think I told you, had...
Can I just get another question in before we go on? On this air gun exercise, how, in fact, was movement simulated?
We did that because the gun was mounted in what we called a RIPER, which was a skeleton turret which rotated on a base which was contoured. So the turret used to go up and down like this, you see, which simulated the motion of the tank.
So you're firing your air gun from an up
from
and
a
down.
From a moving platform, that's
I
right,
see, yes.
Which was rocking there as a tank would.
Yes. What was the proportion of training given to gun work as opposed to machine gun work?
Difficult to say. I would think that probably we spent more time on the machine guns merely because stripping and reassembling the machine gun there was probably slightly more complicated than stripping or maintaining your main armament, and all the stoppages which machine guns were liable to do and how you cleared them, etc. We did a lot of that. So I should think probably time-wise we might have spent more time on the machine gun training. Also, there wasn't the same limit on the amount of ammunition you could fire, so you could do more live training. I think time-wise we probably spent more time on the machine gun, but I would say the standard of training achieved on each weapon was about the same.
Well, since machine guns were anti-personnel weapons, would I be right in assuming that the orientation of the gunnery training was the use of these weapons against infantry and other...
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. It was very much stressed that the use of the tank main armament was only against other tanks. And that when you, if, for example, as the theory then was, and in fact was borne out by the Germans very largely in the initial advance in the last war, the initial breakthrough in France, if the tanks break through, then the majority of the time they are going to be firing at soft targets for which you used your machine gun. You only used your gun in those days, which only had an armour-piercing shot, which is perhaps important, because latterly tank guns from fairly about second or third year of the last war had high explosive shell. Now, we had no high explosive shell in those days. We had the only shot we had was solid armour-piercing shot. They did have a small explosive charge in the tail, the idea being that after the armour-piercing shot had gone through the enemy tank, it then burst inside. But it was that was subsequently abandoned because they reckoned that you could get such a small charge in the back of the bullet, it didn't really make any difference. So that you could say, practically speaking, we were considering solid shot in those days. And of course, solid shot are only useful against armour and so on, because if you put them against a soft vehicle, unless you hit some vital part, it would just go in one side and out the other.
On the basis of this training course, with its considerable including of simulated exercises, as far as your main armament was concerned, when you left the course, did you feel confident you could actually hit something on the
military? Oh, yes, indeed. And I would say we used to carry out gunnery training with battalions. Every battalion used to spend a fortnight doing its gunnery training at Lulworth each year. And the results obtained, I would say, on the whole, were satisfactory. That the number of hits on the targets and so on really were quite satisfactory. I would say the training of gunners in those days, with the weapons we had, were satisfactory.
I'm still not entirely clear from our discussion so far in relating the training exercises you've described to me.